Hi, Mary.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm Sarah Posner, and this is the Posner Show. And my guest today is Mary Hunt. She is the co-founder and the co-director of the Women's Alliance for Theology, Ethics, and Ritual in Silver Spring, Maryland. She is a well-known feminist Catholic theologian, and she's going to talk with me today about the new Pope, Pope Francis. And before we start, Mary, I just wanted to note that among your many other degrees, you do have a master's in divinity from a Jesuit seminary, and that you've also spent time teaching and working in Argentina. So I think that given your background, I'm confident that you're going to give us some unique and interesting insights into the new Pope. So let's start with the fact that he is the first Jesuit Pope. Is there any significance to this in your mind?
Well, the significance of that is that orders don't necessarily like to have their priests become bishops or cardinals, much less popes. So this is the first time that there's been a Jesuit pope. And it does set up a little bit of a problem in the sense that the Jesuits take a fourth vow, not just poverty, chastity, and obedience, but they actually also take a fourth vow of obedience to the Pope. So there's a bit of a theological conundrum here. How does one take a vow of obedience to oneself? I guess it makes you awfully obedient. I don't really know, but I think that's one of the problems that theologians will puzzle over for centuries to come. How does one take a vow to oneself?
So were you surprised when you heard who the new pope was?
Yes, in fact, I was surprised, but not for very long, because then I began to put the pieces together, and it became quite clear that I was right in what I had said in my Religion Dispatches piece, now what, a week and a half or so ago, when I said that the whole thing was done before they got there. And I think his election proves that.
Well, I think to the casual observer, they had what, three, four, five ballots? What
There
were
was
they?
one, there was one ballot on the first day, and then there were four ballots on the second day. So the fifth ballot, exactly.
So what makes you think that it was pretty much a done deal? I mean, he was the runner-up,
he
so
was
to
a,
speak,
yes, he was
to Benedict.
the runner-up to Benedict. And I think that that showed that in this conclave, and the players had not changed all that appreciably in 8 years. I think it shows that the basic trajectory toward what he is and how he is and how he is like Benedict and how Benedict is like John Paul the Second is quite clear. And that is to say that this is a very conservative, doctrinally very conservative gentleman who toes the church line on virtually every church issue. The one thing that he has distinguished himself about has been to suggest that women who have babies and bring the babies to be baptized, even though the mothers are not married to the fathers of the babies, he has said they should be able to be baptized. Now, in the 21st century, that in my book does not count for much. So,
Right,
when you look at his track record on other issues, if you can see how clearly he parallels the John Paul II, Benedict, now Francis, view of church. And if you watched his mass this morning, and I don't know why I do these things, but I did watch his mass this morning with the cardinals, you can see that there's absolutely no deviation from the norm. A lot of publicity is being given to his simplicity of lifestyle and his humbleness. But in fact, in the mass this morning, it was very interesting in the Sistine Chapel that the cardinals were seated in front of the grill. The people who were not cardinals were seated behind the grill when it came time for communion. The cardinals took the communion themselves. The lay people and other priests, presumably, who were behind the grill had to kneel on a kneeler and receive communion on their tongues. I mean, this is like something out of the Middle Ages in terms of
Really?
American Catholicism, where people walk up to communion and put
Right.
their hands out and receive. So I don't mean to be too technical or in-house on this, but those are the kinds of things that show me, as a theologian, that one sees what one gets here, and one gets what one sees, and this is not altogether very different. And I think that was his appeal, and I think going into the conclave, knowing that they had somebody who could garner that many votes, made it quite clear that they just need to persuade a few people, and that was that. The fact that, that sort of the cherry on top is that he's from Latin America, so that
Right.
looks different. And the other, the sort of the second cherry is that he's a Jesuit, and that cuts both ways. So it's a pretty, as far as I can see, it's a pretty done deal. It was a pretty done deal.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, I think it's not a surprise that they would have picked somebody who was very conservative and doctrinally conservative and very conservative on issues of sex and gender. It's not like anybody expected this group of cardinals to vote for somebody who didn't fall into that line. So obviously, there were a lot of candidates who met those criteria. But one of the other things that a lot of people were talking about ahead of the conclave was that this new pope would need to deal with a lot of the corruption and the sex abuse scandal and some of these internal things at the Vatican that Benedict was kind of notoriously too scholarly or theologian-like to deal with all this bureaucratic stuff. And so, but why? What's in Francis's dossier that would have made him a logical choice for that reason?
Well, I don't know if it's a logical choice, but he certainly was a good compromise choice because I think many people could feel comfortable with him. That is to say, people who, and remember, this is all among very conservative people, but among very conservative people, they could feel confident that he would hold the line doctrinally. They could feel that so that the very right wing would be happy, the more left wing of this very conservative crowd would also think that he, as a person who has almost no pastoral experience but only administrative experience, would be able to do what needs to be done with the Curia. And that is all that seems to be the major task at this point, which is to reform the Curia. Now, remember that people like myself have no interest in these things because we think this is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And that,
right.
In fact, what needs to happen is that we need a new boat, and or we need several boats, and that we need a very different model of church. So I'm speculating here on the basis of things that I'm really not particularly interested in and don't think make a hill of beans of difference. But in fact, in terms of parsing it in a Catholic way, that's exactly what's going on, is that, mm-hmm. he pleased enough people on both sides to be able to get him through. He's also not a young man. He's probably not the healthiest Pope that ever
He only has one lung.
People apparently live quite well with one lung. But I think that the real issue is that this probably will not be a long pontificate, and that probably helped people to make the choice. There might have even been a deal done that, you know, when he hits 80, he resigns like his predecessor did and goes off to pastor in Castel Gandolfo, and then maybe we'll have three popes in the Vatican at that point. So, you know, anything is possible. I also think the Latin American thing should not be played down. I think many people in Latin America are very pleased that there is a Latin American Pope. But Latin America is a very big place. And Argentina, mm-hmm. as you know from knowing my experience there, is a very unique place in Latin America, probably along with Uruguay, the most Europeanized. So someone suggested today that, in fact, he was an Italian who just happened by accident of birth to be born.
His parents are Italian, right?
Yeah. So, but I think the fact is that he is a Latin American, that shows that there is a trajectory toward the developing world. I mean, heaven forfend, there aren't, you know, all that many Catholics to make a quorum in most of Europe today. So it's certainly a good business decision. And I think this is basically a business deal. You know, this is really how do you keep the corporation going with the best kind of leadership. Now, it doesn't mean the most robust kind of leadership, but somebody who will at least maintain the status quo, and I think this man can confidently be considered someone who will do that. So I'm of the mind that things will not change much anytime soon.
Well, let's talk about Argentina a bit. You know, so in the United States, Catholics do not think uniformly on a lot of things that the Vatican stands for. Birth control, homosexuality, women's ordination. I mean, there's a lot of diversity of opinion among American Catholics on those kinds of issues. Is that also true in Argentina?
Absolutely.
Among Argentinian Catholics?
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Not as well organized as here, probably because of some of our tax laws and so forth that make it a little bit different, a little easier here to organize these things. But certainly among rank and file Catholics in Argentina, there is a wide variety of views on all of these issues. That's the case all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the long history in Argentina, which is probably the most salient point about this gentleman, the long history of the involvement of the church with various governments. And certainly during the dictatorship was the time that I lived in Argentina. I spent 2 years, 1980 and 1981, teaching at ICIDET, which is the theological school of the Protestant churches. Kind of like Union Seminary in New York. That would be mm-hmm. sometimes called Union Seminary in Buenos Aires. And
right.
I was a visiting professor there for 2 years and learned a lot, I must say. And that was during the so-called Dirty War. That mm-hmm. was 1980 and 81. And that was a time when this pope was at that point in the leadership of the Jesuits. And I belonged to a group. We had a group at the seminary that was actually among seminary professors and theologians in the city, a group of people who favored human rights and who worked on human rights. And I had the privilege of being a part of that group. It met 1 month at our seminary, 1 month at the Jewish seminary. The Jewish counterpart to our dean was, and you may know this name, Sarah, Rabbi Marshall Meyer,
mm-hmm.
To whom Jacob Timmerman dedicated his book, Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. And Marshall Meyer was a heroic person in the dealing with the dictatorship in the Dirty War. There wasn't a Jesuit in our group, I'm sad to say. And I had just graduated from a Jesuit school in Berkeley. I'd done mm-hmm. a Master of Divinity with the Jesuits and then a doctorate with a Jesuit advisor. And I was rather surprised then that there were no Jesuits in this group. And very few Catholics, maybe one or two from our seminary faculty that was actually ecumenical. But that, I think, is the answer to the question people want to ask about what did Francis do when, what did Francis know when, in terms of the two Jesuit priests who were kidnapped
right.
in Argentina. And in fact, I don't think we have the data on that at this point, but I think it will turn out to be that it was more, as it were, sins of omission, what he didn't do, or the Jesuitical, if you will, choice that he made to work behind the scenes. And in those days, I had the privilege of being a volunteer in the office of Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, who was the Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1980 for his work with the Mothers of the Disappeared, Las Madres de Plaza de Mayo, and with other groups that were working on human rights abuses during that time. And Adolfo came out with a statement yesterday that was very interesting to me, saying that, in fact, when he was cardinal, the now Pope Francis was not involved in helping the dictatorship. Adolfo said he knew other people who were involved, and this guy wasn't. And I have to say, I take Adolfo very seriously as a mm-hmm. source. So I think it's pretty clear that he wasn't among the worst. But did he distinguish himself as a human rights leader? Was he public in his speaking out in favor of the mothers and grandmothers of the disappeared, in fact, of the disappeared themselves? The answer to that is no.
Right. You said that was a Jesuitical position to take, to work behind the scenes. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know what the term Jesuitical means. It means a kind of trickery or sleight of hand or things that are done rather like we would say like this. You know, if you do your hand like this in Spanish, it means you know, sort of taking things. Jesuitical means very crafty, cunning. It's not the most flattering word in the world, and there isn't an equivalent for Dominicans or Benedictines. So that tells you something. But something that's done in a Jesuitical way is to say that it's done rather craftily with a certain cunning. And I think that there's certainly evidence that the cardinal at that point, who was the provincial of the Jesuits, figured out a way so that he, rather than another priest, would celebrate the Eucharist in the home of one of the generals or the church of one of the generals and have an opportunity to press for the release of these kidnapped priests. But that's kind of behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. In front of, you know, in the foreground, what you're dealing with is someone who, as a Latin American, as a theologian, and as a Jesuit, opposed and continues to oppose liberation theology. And he opposed the participation of priests and members of his community. I assume that means seminarians and brothers as well. He opposed their working in base communities. Now, that's what people in the 70s and 80s did in Latin America to try to be helpful to the poor. So people made poor, I should say. I don't like to talk about the poor, but people who are made poor by economic structures. So it's very hard to square up that kind of opposition to Latin American liberation theology, which in my mind was and I actually wrote a doctoral dissertation on feminist theology comparing it with Latin American liberation theology. So I've read some of it. But I think it's very hard to square that up with what was actually going on in his own country at the time. I think that's something we need to talk about and we need to think about. We need to get more evidence and information about, and hope that maybe he learned from that one has to handle things differently. By contrast, now, with a president who is much more liberal and progressive, in
right.
a country that has same-sex marriage and so forth, he's had no compunction about raising his voice publicly in the social and political arena to denounce certainly divorce in Argentina, which has been late in coming, to denounce abortion, and to denounce same-sex marriage in very graphic terms, very hurtful terms.
Right, so let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
So recently, it was in the past year or two, right, that same-sex marriage became legal in Argentina, and he led the opposition.
That's
basically.
Right. He was the loyal opposition, as it were.
Right.
He led the opposition most unsuccessfully in the same way that people like Archbishop Coeur de Lion out in Oakland, who's now running the American strategy against same-sex marriage. They lose miserably. But you can see that the issue is not whether you win or lose, especially on those issues. The issue is how you get your spurs, how you show your bona fides, how you get the notch that says, oh, yes, or punch your ticket. This is what I'm going to do. And I've written about this before with lots of people, including people like Cardinal Wuerl and others.
Who's the Archbishop of Washington, D.C.
The Cardinal of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. That's right. And he, in fact, took himself out to Seattle. He was deputized in Seattle some years ago to help out in the case of Archbishop Hunthausen, who was considered soft on issues of women and gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, and so forth. And Mr. Wuerl was sent out there. And, of course, he didn't succeed particularly well and then ended up getting Pittsburgh as his reward. But he showed that he was a loyal man of the company. And so it doesn't really matter whether you're the same with Coeur de Lion. I predict that Mr. Coeur de Lion will be cardinal very soon. And I think it's not whether he wins or loses with Maggie Gallagher on same-sex marriage, but whether he plays the game. And that's exactly what happened in Argentina. This guy mm-hmm, lost miserably.
Mm-hmm.
The president publicly rebuked him for talking about the fact that same-sex marriage was connected with the father of lies, as he
right.
put it. El padre de las mentiras. I mean, what a thing to say. And then he went on to say that people like me who are same-sex loving people who adopt children or who have children of our own discriminate against our children. Very
right.
hard to imagine how we do that. But this is his view. And this is a very hurtful thing to say. This is a very
yeah.
true thing to say. And it's a very unhelpful thing to say. And I hope as Pope he realizes that and stops saying it because it's absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So did he get any – you said that because of the tax laws in Argentina, there's a little less organized opposition. You know, you don't have these nonprofits and advocacy groups and so on that you might in the United States of dissenting Catholics. You know, so here in the United States, there's a number of organizations that advocate for same-sex marriage, that advocate for reproductive choice, that advocate for women's ordination and things like that, and had the Archbishop of wherever – I mean, and bishops in the United States have made – you know, comparably hurtful comments like that, and you'll get pushback from groups like that
right.
when something like that happens. Did that happen in Argentina?
Yes.
Or was this pushback
from
people who weren't Catholic?
Yes, there is, for example, a Catholics for Choice group in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been very good and very helpful and have had the resources of Catholics for Choice in all of Latin America, the Mexican office especially, and some of the folks in Uruguay and Brazil have been very strong. So there's always pushback from them.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly around the same-sex marriage, there was pushback not only from Catholics, but also from a variety of Protestant groups. Who themselves were some, for example, Lutherans, were very progressive on this question relative
mm-hmm.
to the Catholics. So they pushed back against the Catholics, but it's just not organized in the same way, and yet they won. And
right.
this is because their government, in some ways, pays less attention to the church than ours does, and they don't have, I think, as high a concentration of very conservative Catholic legislators as we do in this country.
You know, that's interesting.
Types. And I think that for that reason, some of the opposition to the Catholic stuff is just washes over. They don't even need to respond to them because they're not taken as seriously. And I think that's what happened on the same-sex marriage question.
Uh-huh.
I could be wrong about that. It'd be interesting to talk with some friends there. But people I know in Argentina who are part of the Methodist Church, Metropolitan Community Church, Lutherans, they were all over these questions. But some of their own leadership was, certainly the MCC, but the leadership of the Lutherans and some of the Methodists were so good on this that the Catholics they simply couldn't make it stick. The other thing is a myth about Latin America, and certainly about Argentina, is that everybody's Catholic, and everybody's not Catholic.
Right, right.
And there's also a very strong progressive Jewish community in Buenos Aires. There are many evangelical churches, not just evangelical, as we say, of Protestant churches, but also of what we consider more conservative evangelical churches. But I think that the Catholic Church has lost so much stature, and lost so much during the Dirty War, when the bishops did not stand up. They lost a lot of the stature that the Catholic bishops in this country have lost over sexual abuse. The Catholic bishops there already had lost over the war. The famous picture of the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo going to the place where the bishops were having their retreat, and it was taken over the shoulder of one of the women and looking at the bishops, and the bishops were on one side of the fence and the women were on the other, and a more telling image one couldn't find of the church not standing with the people. So I get a little perplexed by this notion that this gentleman is on the side of the poor. I don't really know what that means exactly, especially poor women who need abortions, or poor men who are gay, or poor children who are abused. I don't know what it means to be on the side of the poor if, in fact, at the level of legislation and social cultural things, you are not standing with people every day as we try to do in this country and certainly in other parts of the world. So I haven't yet been persuaded of that, but just being Latin American doesn't make you stand on the side of the poor. I think that's one of the things we need to talk about, that this man is not one of them, but there are many wealthy people in Latin America whose perspectives on these things are not particularly progressive, and there are people like this gentleman who actually comes from the middle class or even working class people who have not necessarily made the same kind of option. Having said that, it's also true that living in Latin America is a different experience for everyone, and so there is a way in which he hopefully is touched by and affected by those things. But again, I don't want to go too far into this here, because I think it gets us off track of what's really at hand here, which is that the big changes that we need in Catholicism are not going to come from him or any other pope. They're going to come from the ground up, from new structures and new forms of governance. And that we have not only no evidence of, but to the contrary, we've now had 2 weeks of media saturation of a way of doing business, a way of being symbols and images that I think only reinforce and reinscribe all of that. So it's very difficult, I think, to be all that optimistic at this point.
Well, one of the things that really struck me in a lot of the media coverage was this discussion of his, there was sort of a meme that took root, which was that he very much cares about the poor. And there was this photograph of him washing the feet of a patient at a hospital who had AIDS, and that, you know, he rode the bus and lived in an apartment and cooked his own meals and all of those things that all of us have heard in the past 2 days. But I thought Marion Ronan made a really good point in the piece she did for RD, which was, you know, half the world's population are women, and, right, you know, presumably roughly half, you know, of the world's poor are women, maybe even more. And how are they not going to become less poor if you don't provide them with, or don't allow them access to, contraception and full reproductive health care? And, you know, she raised a number of other issues too. But to me, like, it struck me that his social justice values, as they were portrayed, were just taken at face value without, I felt like a lot of the coverage just sort of celebrated his, what was portrayed as his compassion for the poor, which he may indeed have, but this did not get translated in any way into, well, what would he do as Pope to actually do anything about this?
Well, I hope he has compassion for the poor. I mean, how, you know, everyone should have compassion for the poor, but that's not the issue. The issue is, how are people made poor and how are people kept poor?
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, if take the AIDS example, you know, the myth now is that he went to a hospital and he washed the feet of 12 AIDS patients, he asked for water and could I wash their feet? So lovely, marvelous, symbols are important. Mm-hmm. But if you are in a position of responsibility and power, and especially in a religious system that has political power, that is the power to change how governments provide health care, and you say that people should not be able to use condoms,
right,
then you're surprised if people get HIV/AIDS, and your response to that is to go and wash their feet. I think that's wholly inadequate. I think that's sort of the Mother Teresa approach, that Mother Teresa was very much, and people who worked for her said the same thing, maybe had her heart in the right place, but in terms of what it takes to eradicate poverty, what it takes to prevent disease, is very different than garden variety Christian charity. It takes hard work, it takes solid analysis, and it takes courage to say, we did that for a long time and it didn't work. Now, if we really have compassion for people who are poor, we will be sure that each and every one of them has access to the contraceptive devices that they need, that each person has access to condoms as a barrier method to for the prevention of disease, and that we begin to put our energies and our focus not just on loving the poor, but in eradicating poverty so that people are not made poor anymore. That's what I want to see, and that's what I have not seen. And I must say I'm pessimistic about that, and that's very disappointing. And I think you're right that the media, now they've only had 28 hours to deal with this, but you know, it takes some time. That's why I haven't written anything yet, because I've been trying to sift through everything I can read. By way of background, my friends in Argentina have been sending me materials, and I'm really trying to piece it together with my own sense of Argentina, what it was like to be there, what it is like to have been there a dozen times since I came home. But it's to try to put myself in that mindset in order to say something analytically useful about what could go on here.
Right.
Not just to repeat or rehearse bits of stories that we get told about someone, which are admittedly lovely, but you know, what do they amount to when it comes to actually doing the work that needs to be done in the 21st century? I'm not sure.
Well, just to close out here, I mean, do you have any expectation then that in our lifetimes, the Catholic
Church... How long are you going to live, Sarah?
Okay, your lifetime?
Yeah, right.
You know, because it seems to me that the church as an institution doesn't seem to care that there are dissenting Catholics, that there are Catholics who are in disagreement with them on a host of issues, principally relating to sex and sexuality.
Yeah.
But do you have any, it seems like the more there's dissent among Catholics, the more the church just says, well, no, you know, we won't tolerate dissent. We'll send investigators to see about the nun's radical feminist ideology.
Yeah, it's quite laughable, isn't it? But yeah, this is what'll be very interesting. And this is where he is, in my mind, again, a pivotal figure vis-a-vis the question of, does he really want what Cardinal Ratzinger put out during the reign of John Paul II, which was really the first reign of Ratzinger. Ratzinger's really had two pontificates, in my view. He has had his own, which he's completed by resigning. And he had the second part of John Paul II's, where he really was effectively functioning as Pope. So we're seeing some new administrative models here. And he may have a third now. I mean, my view is that Ratzinger voted early and often in this election, and that he was very much a part of making this selection of the person who was second to him the last time. That's mm-hmm. my own view. I obviously wasn't there, but we'll see if history bears me out. I think the problem is that what Ratzinger wanted was a leaner, meaner church. And it really doesn't matter if people who are progressive sort of peel off on the sides, because the hard core of it stays the same. That is something that I think has to change now. And I think the media has a very important role to play in that, which frankly and honestly, most of them did not play in this papal transition time. I think we'll have another shot at this probably in 5 or 10 years. But mm-hmm. I think that this kind of uncritical, fawning acceptance of things as they're presented does not help, because there's no religious tradition, neither Judaism nor Islam nor even the whole World Council of Churches panoply of Protestantism, that functions as an alternative religious worldview for the world. So what gets presented to the world is the Catholic patriarchal way of doing things. And with no opposition to that, and I didn't hear, and I saw a lot of coverage, I'm bleary-eyed from watching this stuff for the last 2 weeks.
Right.
I saw almost nobody from what I would consider progressive groups. I didn't see anybody from the SNAP group that works on sexual abuse. I didn't see anybody from the Women's Ordination Conference. I didn't see anybody from the gay and lesbian groups actually interviewed or brought in to comment on mainstream media.
Right.
Maureen Fiedler is the most progressive person, and she's been on the Diane Rehm show, and she's on CBS Morning. Mm-hmm. She's on as a journalist. She's a nun, but she's a journalist.
Right.
Maureen's done a marvelous job, but she would be the edgiest kind of person. None of the other people with whom I work have been brought in at all in terms of media. I saw something that Matthew Fox did, but it wasn't mainstream by any means. So I think that's a real problem that we're up against. And the real story is not with the Pope, I think, but with the growing gathering groups of people who come from the Catholic tradition who are making various mature choices about their own spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those include going to other churches or becoming so-called nuns that don't have any religious affiliation any longer.
N-O-N-E-S, right.
N-O-N-E-S. Some are becoming nuns, too, but I have to say that. And some of the progressive nuns are just marvelous. But I think that's really where the story is. And it'll be interesting to see now that the numbers have tipped. We're really at a critical point on homosexuality, on women's ordination, mm-hmm. on abortion choice, contraception in this country. But, you know, this was a smart, again, Jesuitical move. This gentleman is from the developing world, and that's where the growth is.
Right.
So, you know, in the African churches and in some of the Latin American churches that are competing mightily against Pentecostal evangelical people, this is really shoring up the base in places mm-hmm. where there are numbers. I think they've written off. I mean, I think Cardinal Ratzinger now, Pope Emeritus, rather gave up on Europe. That was the signal of his pontificate was to really try to get Europe back in the fold. That failed miserably.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter whether you win or lose for these guys. It's just that you show that you want to do it.
Right.
So I think that so to have another European pope probably wasn't very good for business. And this is certainly a good business move. No question about it.
Well, listen, this was a really great discussion. I'm really glad we got a chance to do it.
I'm glad we did too, and I wish you the best. And I'm so glad that Religion Dispatches does what it does, because it really does provide a forum for I think alternative and important and increasingly powerful voices. So thanks for your work.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay, take care, Sarah.